This evening's reading is taken from 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 1 to 6. This may be found on page 1148 of the Church Bibles. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 1 to 6. Now for the matters you wrote about, it is good for a man not to marry, but since there is so much immorality about, each man should have his own wife, and each woman her own husband. The husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife, and likewise the wife to her husband. The wife's body does not belong to her alone, but also to her husband. In the same way, the husband's body does not belong to him alone, but also to his wife. Do not deprive of each other, except by mutual consent and for a time, so that you may devote yourself to prayer. Then come together again, so Satan will not tempt you because of the lack of self-control. I say this as a concession, not as a command.
Thank you very much, Fred. Well, the subject of this evening's passage is sex inside marriage. And Paul's aim in our passage is to stop the Corinthians from abandoning sex within their marriages. Now, immediately I can imagine someone might say, hold on, everybody in our world seems to be saying that sex is great. How could a married couple possibly need encouragement in this area? What's wrong with them? Surely there are now no restraints, no problems. Once he or she has said, I will, it's on with the honeymoon and off with the shackles. But the church in Corinth was a young church in a society where there was a widely held view that the soul was imprisoned in the body. The soul was pure, but the body was not. Some people were therefore saying that if you wanted to be really pure, you needed to abandon everything or anything that was physically pleasurable. Didn't matter whether it was food or drink or sex or whatever. Anything that was pleasurable and physical was in danger of hindering your spiritual growth. What's more, for the church in Corinth, Paul, their role model, didn't appear himself to have been married. He didn't seem actively himself to be seeking marriage. He'd been telling them that sexual immorality, that is, sexual behavior outside of marriage, was wrong. So it's not hard, you see, if you've got these two aspects coming together, Paul and his advice about sexual immorality, and their contemporary secular view about the soul and the body, if you've got those two ideas coming together, it's not hard to see how these young and untaught Christians, beginning to get the idea that sexual experience, even sexual experience inside marriage, was somehow sub-spiritual. Just look at verse 1 of our passage. And before I read it, may I just point out that the NIV, the Bible footnote at the bottom, gives us a better translation of the phrase. Because the word used to marry is a word, or which they translate in the main text to marry, is actually a word which is translated everywhere else to touch. And again, because Paul introduces the subject by telling us he's about to address the issues they had written to him about, it seems much more sensible to go for the footnote. Come and attack me on that if you want to afterwards. But now for the matters you wrote about. To the footnote, they say it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman. So I hope you can see the issue. And I hope you can see why it has arisen. Some married men and women in the Corinthian congregation were saying, in order to enhance my spiritual progress, it's better for us, as a married couple, to abstain from sex. There was a kind of super spiritual cult of celibacy. And to be honest, that is not all that unusual in Christian history. You may be sitting there thinking, what on earth has that got to do with us? Throughout the history of the church, people have been tempted to have a downer on sex. In the 3rd century, one Christian church leader actually taught that the Holy Spirit leaves the room when a couple are having sex. Between the 5th and the 7th century, it was believed that sexual intercourse was so impure that church leaders were encouraged not to sleep with their wives before taking services of Holy Communion, which was fine when communion was once a week, But as more and more services came in and feast days crept in and all that, so it became some sort of problem. It's not a reason why we have communion just once a term here at St. Helens. Now today we come out of a society, all of us, when God's good and safe creation plan for sex has been abandoned on a massive scale. Many of us here, I guess, this evening have experienced damage and hurt in this whole area. And I guess for many of us, we carry a whole sort of baggage with us from pre-Christian history or whatever. It is very common for Christians to react against this harmful abuse of sex by then swinging the other way and saying all sex is somehow dirty, unclean, second best, impure. Certainly the outside world thinks that that's what we think. Listen to this recent comment. Nothing ruins your sexual prospects like being a religious maniac. All that praying and fasting and listening to Paul plays havoc with your hormones. Church people are all the same, frustrated and repressed. But as we look at this passage, Paul speaking, we're going to find that that view is miles from the truth. And like last week, we're going to find that Paul has a far higher view of sex than the outside world does. And like last week, he gives us three simple staccato commands. First, verse 2, be sure to keep sex on the agenda in marriage. Don't abandon it. Literally, verse 2 reads like this. Okay, verse 1. Now, for the matters you wrote about, you said it's good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman. But, on the contrary, in view of sexual immorality, each man his own wife, let him have. And each woman her own husband, let her have. And straight away we hit a problem. So you may have heard some people say that this passage means that the way to avoid sexual immorality is to get married. Let me make this clear. It's mid-March. Spring is in the air. Paul is not saying that if you're feeling remotely sexually tempted, you should just get out there and find a wife. No, he is speaking to married couples who reckon that sex is a less spiritual thing and so have stopped sleeping with one another for super spiritual reasons. And just a close look at the verse 2 will make that clear. I want to make this clear because some people have taught that if you feel remotely sexually tempted, you just need to get on and find a wife and stop being so idle. But I don't think verse 2 says that. The word let him have, each man should have, the word let him have is never used in the Greek of taking a wife. Paul uses a different verb when he wants to tell people to get married, even in this passage. The word let him have is used in the Greek of those who are already married in order to tell them to continue with sex in marriage. The command let him have is in the present continuous, let him go on having sexually his wife. And therefore it naturally seems to allude to somebody who is already married. And Paul is about to argue for the value of singleness. It seems highly unlikely, therefore, that he's going to say to everybody, whoever they are, just get out there and get married. And even verse 8, which reads, to the unmarried, there are very, very strong reasons for taking verse 8 to be to widowers and widows, not to the unmarried generally. Again, tackle me afterwards if you want to go into more depth on that. But Paul is not telling us all to go and get married. I hope that stops the stampede. Paul's point is this. In view of sexual immorality in the society in which we live, married men and women must not abandon sex. See the danger? There is a real danger that if married couples aren't sleeping together, they might go and find a partner outside of marriage. Married Christians are no different to anybody else in society. They can be tempted to sexual immorality, just the same as anyone else. So the way married couples are to flee immorality is to keep sleeping together. Now, last week we saw some of the reasons why sexual immorality was so dreadful, and why, therefore, Paul tells us to avoid it at all costs. We looked at the insecurity created by sexual immorality. God's purpose in creating sex is not that we just charge around from one partner to another. God's stated purpose in creating sexual intercourse was that it should both enable children and also unite or cement or bond a couple together in a deep emotional, physical, and spiritual union. Sex is designed by God to be an act whereby one man exposes himself and gives himself wholly to one woman for life. And one woman exposes herself and gives herself wholly and completely to one man for life. That's the point of verse 16 of chapter 6. The two will become one flesh. You simply cannot give yourself unreservedly and without holding anything back to a person who may not be there in the morning, or next week, or next month, or in 3 years' time, or in 10 years' time. However much you may say, well, I love you. So the insecurity created by sexual immorality, and that's just before the children come along. Then we looked last week at the damage created by sexual immorality. You can't join yourself to one person, exposing yourself at the deepest level, and then join yourself to another, and another, and then tear yourself apart and join yourself to another, and another, without doing real damage, emotional, psychological, spiritual, even physical. But last week, even more important than the insecurity and the damage, do you remember we saw that the spiritual wreckage caused by sexual immorality, to engage in sexual immorality is to cock a snoop at God, to say, I just don't give a monkey's for your best plan. I'm going to run my life my way without any reference to what you say as my creator, my master, my owner. God's safe and secure setting for sex is within marriage. And it is pathetic, and a number of you have said this to me this week, isn't it pathetic to hear the phrase safe sex used to encourage teenagers and adults to continue in willful sexual immorality? You know, if it weren't so tragic, you and I ought to mock the secular world mercilessly over their complete failure to think in the area of sex. The secular world which surrounds us worships sex, treating it as the highest experience available, and yet at the same time devalues it so much as to encourage a 13-year-old just to use a condom, or to nod and wink as a 40-year-old has a mistress. I just want to say, if you're not a Christian here this evening, and if you're not a Christian here this evening, I want to encourage you to go home and to think about the chaos that is caused in our secular world by the world's abandoning of the Maker's instructions in this area. I don't know if you heard of the teenager writing his GCSE RE exam answer. In Christianity, you can only have one wife for life. This is called monotony. How far from the truth. When you're committed 100% for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness, in health, to one person, till death you part, well then, of course, you can expose yourself and open yourself and give yourself and cement yourself unreservedly, without fear or damage or hurt or rejection or spiritual consequences. Sex makes sense in that setting. It is safe. And so says Paul, in view of the seriousness of sexual immorality, the damage, the insecurity, the spiritual chaos in your relationship with God, make sure that you married couples don't give up having sex together. Otherwise, one of you is going to be tempted. So Paul's aim is to stop the Corinthians from abandoning sex in marriage. His first point, be sure to keep sex on the agenda, verse 2. Don't abandon it. Secondly, be sure to be selfless about sex in marriage. Don't be selfish about it. And Paul's point here is that husbands and wives have an ongoing physical obligation to one another throughout their marriage. Verse 3, he uses the word for a debt or an obligation. It's the same way that's used for paying taxes to Caesar. Let me read verse 3 to you. The husband, to the wife, the debt, let him pay. And likewise also the wife, to the husband. And then in verse 4 he goes on, for the woman is not master over her own body. The man is. And the man is not master or does not have power or authority over his own body in this area. The woman does. Now do you see that when a person gets married, they therefore enter into or take on a lifelong obligation or debt to satisfy their partner sexually. And when a person gets married, as well as taking on an obligation, they also give up or hand over a lifelong independence over their own body. Current Church of England marriage service runs something like this. With my body I honour you. All that I am I give to you, and all that I have I share with you, within the love of God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. It should have a promise somewhere in it that reads something like this. I guess it's contained in With My Body I Honour You. But it should have a phrase that runs something like this. Jemima, or whoever it happens to be, I promise to give myself up in order to provide lifelong sexual satisfaction for you. Just as well it doesn't, because I think Granny's false teeth might come out as she splutters over it in the third row. But I want you to see the impact on these super spiritual Corinthians who thought that sex in marriage was somehow second best or dirty, and that there were more spiritual ways of going about life. They were endlessly heading off to their Christian meetings, busily pursuing their spiritual goals, boastfully conducting their spiritual exercises, but they decided not to sleep with their husbands. Instead of giving up their independence and handing over their body, as it were, they were hanging on to it. Instead of paying their debt, they were running up a bill. Now, we'll come on to that in just a moment, but before we do, I want us to pause for a moment and look at the kind of implications that this command has for Christian marriages. I know many of us here are not married. I guess at least 20% are married, and therefore we need to hear it. Numbers will be married, and therefore we need to hear it. And anyway, we need to know the right way that God intends sex to be conducted and handled. May I say that you will find a right Christian perspective on sex is a hugely powerful subject when you come to talking to your non-Christian friends about Christianity. Some of the most brilliant conversations about Christianity can start in on this tack. We come from a society that worships sex but is clueless about the way God made it and what it's for. If you were to ask the average person in the street what they think sex is for, they would say, me and my pleasure. Even if you were to ask the average Christian what they were looking forward to on their honeymoon, one reason they would probably give was the physical pleasure that was going to be opened up to them. Well, how different the Christian way is. You see what Paul is saying here. Just as the gospel informs our understanding of sexual immorality, So the gospel should inform our understanding of sexual practice within marriage. It's no longer me and my gratification that's at the heart of it. It is her and her pleasure, and him and his satisfaction. Now that means that married men today need to learn how to fulfill their debt. What is it that the new master of your body finds most pleasing? Men tend to think of sex as a brief act lasting so long. But women are far more conscious of environment and mood and atmosphere. Someone once said, for the woman, the act of sex begins 12 hours before you go to bed. I don't know quite how true that is. I think it's pretty true. Sex, and it's certainly true that sex for a woman cannot be divorced from the total relationship. And therefore, if we're going to obey this command to provide sexual satisfaction for a woman who we marry, us men must realize that it will involve time, intimacy, personal attention, affirmation, care, tenderness. Those are the things that a woman responds to. Sex cannot just be a timetabled event latched onto the end of a busy day so that your wife is just one among a number of other priorities. Sex can't come on the back of a sharp comment or a bitter exchange or a poor overall relationship. Men cannot just come home from the office or from the surgery or from the RML study, swing in through the bedroom window on the curtains, land with a Tarzan-like whoop in the middle of the bed, and expect the action to start. Look at the adverts, though. Look at the adverts, and you will see that the world places huge store on the independent, cool, hard, detached, macho male. The self-reliant Clint Eastwood figure who shacks up with a girl maybe for a night before heading off into the sunset to Marlborough country in a Ford Mondeo. Nothing is further from the truth of what it means to give your body to your wife in order to provide for her sexual satisfaction, to pay your debt and hand over the ownership of your body to her in order to keep her from immorality. Married men must learn that real selfless Christian sex springs out of a real selfless Christian relationship, where the man has given himself to his wife in every area, and she is undoubtedly number one. And so I hope you will tell your friends who are not Christians that the sexually immoral cannot, by definition, be good lovers. It is impossible, because they haven't given themselves wholeheartedly 100% to the woman they claim to love. Now you women will need to learn. It's rather frightening to tell you women what you need to learn. You'll have to tell me that I'm totally clueless after this, but you need to learn what it means to fulfill your debt to your husband. There will be times when you simply do not feel like sex. Well, you may need to make a conscious decision to allow the emotions to get going. Paul is not saying, when he says your husband has authority over your body and you have a debt to pay, he's not saying that you have to have sex on demand, but the sort of free, independent spirit. The girl with the Fiat Uno who has everything on her own terms, the flat, the career, the hobbies, and the lover who's there for convenience to be picked up and put down whenever she decides, couldn't be further from the selfless view of sex in marriage that Paul commands. Real, selfless, Christian sex springs out of a real, selfless Christian relationship, where the wife is committed to providing selflessly for the husband. See the gospel informing sex in marriage. And again, do you see how God's pure design for sex inside marriage makes such perfect sense? See, only when a man has given himself 100%, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness, in health, till death us do part, only then can his woman be sure of the time, the care, the intimacy, the personal attention. Only when a woman knows that her man is 100% committed is she able to give herself to him, even when she doesn't feel like it, knowing that he will be there in the morning, and in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 50 years. So says Paul. Don't be selfish about sex in marriage. And I know this may sound patronizing. I don't mean to be patronizing. But I want to say that the person who is not yet ready to make one woman the only center of their attention and their affection and the first place in their priority, in their energy, in their time, in their dreams, even ahead of the lads or the football team or the career, that person is not ready for marriage. However strongly they may be sexually tempted, they are not ready. So don't abandon sex in marriage, says Paul. Don't be selfish about sex in marriage, says Paul. Don't steal from one another by being super spiritual about sex in marriage, says Paul. And that's verses 5 to 6, in the beginning of about 5 to 6. And Paul's point here really drives the message home to the super spiritual Corinthians. His point is this: if you keep yourself from your husband or wife, it doesn't really matter how you dress it up. You are robbing them. See, the word he uses in verse 5 is a powerful word. It's the word for theft. The Corinthians were saying, it's more spiritual for me to be praying, to be at my Bible study, to be attending the committee or that meeting or the synod or whatever it happened to be that looks spiritual. It's more important for me to be going about my super spiritual ego trip. Well, on the outside of their marriage, everything would have looked fine and hunky-dory. But behind the closed doors or the net curtains of the Corinthian streets, they were ignoring each other. Separate bedrooms, separate agendas, separate lives. She might just as well have been a piece of furniture for all the intimacy and tenderness and time he gave her. He might just as well have been a lodger for all the sexual attention she gave him. And so verse 5 and 6 is very biting. Do not deprive, rob, thieve from each other, except by mutual consent and for a time, so that you may devote yourself to prayer. Then come together again, so that Satan won't tempt you because of your lack of self-control. And anyway, I say this business about depriving each other just for a time for the sake of the prayer meeting, I say this only as a concession, not as a command. It's only a concession that you're allowed to give up sex for a while for the prayer meeting. It's not a command, because the issue of sexual immorality is so serious that you must not thieve from your wife or husband. And his point is this: it doesn't matter how spiritual your life may look on the outside, if you're not giving your husband or wife his or her proper sexual attention, in the broadest sense that we've looked at it today, if you're not doing that, then however spiritual you may look on the outside, you are robbing her. You're thieving from him. Now, I don't know if you've come across John Richardson's little book. It is outstanding, entitled God, Sex and Marriage. It has the most remarkable cover, and don't let that put you off. I was reading this book going on the train to Cornwall the other day, and I couldn't think why all the ladies started leaving the carriage I was in. And then I looked at it and realised. Let me quote. In the Middle Ages, Eve of Chartres counseled the devout to abstain from sexual intercourse on Thursdays in remembrance of Christ's rapture, on Fridays in remembrance of Christ's crucifixion, on Saturdays in honour of the Virgin Mary. on Sundays in commemoration of Christ's resurrection, and on Mondays out of respect for departed souls. Probably why house groups only got going midweek towards the end of this century. But do you see that far from being spiritual, to abstain from sex in marriage is in reality less spiritual? Paul is saying if you don't provide for your wife or husband, someone else will come along. They will offer her time, intimacy, devotion, and she'll be tempted away. If you don't provide for your husband sexually, someone else will come along. So if you are married, you need to plan your diary to make sure that you are giving your wife her due. Doesn't mean that you have to give up all your Christian service, but it does mean that you need to plan your Christian service so that you allow to spend good time together. Christian service can still be just as much of a priority, but you may not be able to do so much. And you're going to need to plan your life together carefully so that you spend proper time together. And if we're not married, those who aren't married, how easy to expect the married to carry on just as before without urging them to give themselves to their husbands and wives. How easy to expect the married RML Read, Mark, Learn leader to behave in exactly the same way as the single. Or how easy to think that when we do enter marriage, well, we might carry on with the same timetable and the same program and the same responsibilities. I remember a friend of mine startling me when I was a single man by saying that his wife and children were now his first and most important congregation, and so he couldn't come to such and such a meeting. I was surprised. I was highly super spiritual about it. I was wrong. He was right. As he went on to have 5 children, he obviously took his responsibilities very seriously, and church growth was a real commitment. In conclusion then, the Corinthians were super spiritual. They thought it was somehow more holy, more spiritual to stay clear of sex in marriage. Now I want to suggest that because many of us have been converted to Christianity out of a culture which is clueless about sex, where nobody thinks about it, where sex is so dreadfully abused, there will be danger for us to fall into the same trap, both as we talk to our non-Christian friends, to be wagging the finger, instead of teaching the beauty and the rightness of God's creation and how God has made sex to be. We need to think about it and to know why we think sexual immorality is wrong and why we think sex is really important inside marriage. As far as Paul is concerned, there's no turn the lights off and think of Jerusalem. God made sex. It is a good and perfect gift. It is safe in marriage. Don't abandon it, he says. Don't be selfish about it. View it rightly through the gospel. Don't steal from your wife or husband on super spiritual grounds. Next week he moves on to talk about singleness, and we'll be talking about that in a week's time.